Please come to order. The Honorable Susan Van Keulen presiding.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the 2 o'clock calendar. Looks like we had a few little technical wrinkles, which we often do. So let's go ahead and get underway. Ms. Fanthorpe, if you'll call the case, please.
Certainly. Calling case 21-CB-8899. Pajaro Homeless Union et al. Versus Monterey County et al. Council, please identify yourselves for the record, beginning with plaintiff.
Good afternoon, Judge Anthony Prince for plaintiffs.
Mr. Prince, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. My apologies for the IT delays. Marina Panchenko appearing on behalf of all defendants, the County of Monterey, Sheriff's Department, and Sheriff Bernal, as well as the Water Resources Agency. I'm joined in the room with my colleague, Janet Holmes, who's a senior litigation counsel in my office. I worked with her on the briefing in this case, and she'll be making a couple of additional comments to the court today.
Thank you, Ms. Panchenko. All right, we're on today for a hearing on preliminary injunction following the issuance of a TRO by this court last Thursday, and I have reviewed the papers that have been submitted by the parties, both those that came in last week, the defendant's supplemental brief that came in as ordered yesterday. Plaintiff did file a late brief this morning. I did see that, the supporting declarations, as well as the defendant's follow-on motion to strike. So let me just start there. The motion to strike does make a valid point, and that the appropriate response for the plaintiff was to ask for more time, not just to not file anything, and then to file, and indeed to file after the defendants had filed. I've given this some careful consideration. I do appreciate that in these situations where there is a TRO in place and the background facts are moving very quickly. They're not really background, but the facts that give rise to the action are moving quite quickly and necessitate a very expedited process to get to the preliminary injunction hearing, which is where we are today. Against that backdrop, I do appreciate that all facts are critical, and it's important that they all get before the court. So under these unique circumstances, I will deny the motion to strike, as well taken as it may be. I will allow the government an opportunity to respond to those papers if I believe it is outcome determinative. All right. I did ask upon issuing the TRO for supplemental briefing, and in particular, I wanted the parties to address the role of availability or unavailability of alternative housing under these circumstances, particularly as it relates to a state-created danger. And the parties each perhaps touched on that, as well as making other arguments in their respective cases. Let me turn for a moment to landscape so you have a good idea of what I see as pertinent facts in this case, and then you can clarify when you have the floor. In the first point, we are dealing with an encampment on the Pajaro River, or on the levee to the Pajaro River. And it's a fairly large encampment. There is an allegation in the complaint that it approaches 200 persons. If that's not accurate, or there's reason to believe that's not accurate, I'd like to hear about that. I also understand from some of the facts before the court that some of the persons in that encampment have been there for quite some time, whether it's at this very specific site or generally on the levee at or near the Pajaro River. But some campers say they have been there many years. I think one indicated that she had been there for 10 years. I also also note that the land, I don't believe this is disputed, the land is not open to the public. It is not accessible to the public. It is land in a waterway that is heavily regulated by various federal and state agencies. The efforts, there is documentation in the record now before the court of the defendant's efforts to provide notice, at least a week's notice, formal notice of the intent to evict. There is evidence around the placement of possessions, that is an opportunity for possessions to be stored. There is dispute around that. There is evidence of the existence of shelters for persons experiencing homelessness in Monterey County. There is very limited evidence before the court on either side as to the availability of beds in those shelters. And then there is conflicting evidence about whether or not there were motel vouchers offered to some of the campers. And in some papers, the defendants identified 25 motel vouchers for a period of 5 days that had been made available. And that those facts are contested by plaintiffs. The application for the TRO in this case was filed as the evictions were getting underway. And the evictions had been underway approximately 24 hours by the time the TRO was issued. That led this court, as I said, to request supplemental briefing or offer the opportunity for supplemental briefing and to set this hearing on very short notice. Turning to the papers that are before the court, starting with the complaint, the plaintiffs have filed suit for violation of the Eighth Amendment. And similarly, under the California Constitution, alleging cruel and unusual punishment arising out of the evictions from the encampment without alternative housing being available. Plaintiffs have also alleged a violation of due process on the grounds of a state-created danger resulting from the evictions from the camp. And finally, the plaintiffs allege unlawful seizure in violation of the Fourth and 14th Amendment and in violation of 42 U.S.C. 1983. Those claims relate primarily to the personal property, seizure of personal property. As I indicated to the parties in the TRO and in setting this briefing schedule, it really is the first two of those allegations where and the interplay between them that are of particular interest to the court and where I would like the parties to focus their efforts in this hearing this afternoon. And that really formulates into the following questions, which is, what is the impact of limited alternative housing on an eviction of this size and at this time of year? We have a large eviction, we're at this time of year. Again, the evidence before the court of existence of housing, but availability of housing differs. So how does that factor into the appropriate analysis before the court? And the second question is, if there is limited or no housing, does that lead us to a state-created danger? Or is this a situation where, with or without alternative housing, would the plaintiffs be in any worse position than they are now in the present encampment? So it's those interactions and that interplay that the court is particularly interested in. And of course, there is the very significant part of the analysis, which turns to the balance of the equities, the public health and safety concerns, et cetera. And the parties may address that. I'm sure the parties would like to address that. And I welcome that. But I want to be sure that those first two points are covered. All right. So with that in broad brushstrokes, being what the court has seen and what the court is particularly interested in hearing this afternoon, let me turn first to the plaintiffs, Mr. Prince, and hear from you with regards to grounds. On what grounds can a preliminary injunction issue at this point?
Well, thank you, Your Honor. To begin with, the grounds, of course, for a preliminary injunction are the showing that likelihood of success on the merits, which, of course, is in the Ninth Circuit, is sliding scale, and the raising of serious questions going to the merits is the standard for assessing likelihood of success on the merits. And, of course, the issue of irreparable harm, the balance of equities, and the public interest. Answering your first question, Your Honor, the impact of a limited amount of alternative housing on an encampment of this size at this time of year. Yes, as we've briefed, the impact of the even admitting, which we don't, the availability, which we also, which has not been made, which has not been made clear to us, of housing, it pales by comparison to the number of campers impacted.
And is that right? Is the camp approximately 200 people?
It may be larger than that. The figure 200 was provided by a president of the local union, Monica Tone. She's the one who's lived there for 10 years, very familiar with the entire length of the encampment, the river, where it's, the encampments dot the entire length of the river. But the specific area under question, the area targeted on the 17th and 18th, and via the notices posted on November 10th, was an area that comprises of about 200 persons, according to Ms. Tony and others. So it is a large, it's a large segment of an even larger encampment for which there is clearly inadequate housing available. The problem with the nature of the limitation on the housing is, first of all, that the number of the housing would be provided ostensibly by way of vouchers for motel rooms. The number that was represented by the county to have been offered and refused, the number 25, is simply incompatible with the facts as spelled out in our declarations. And we had only one person that we're aware of who came to the encampment as a associated with Cal State University Monterey Bay and their support program to the county. And he admitted that he only had five vouchers when he initially arrived on the 18th. There was no vouchers available or even represented to be available on the 17th. It wasn't until the next morning that took place. But even if they were, even if this individual came to the encampment on the 17th, he admitted, and there, I don't think there's any dispute, that he had only five. He didn't produce the five or actually physically show the five. And he indicated when confronted by campers that that would not be enough, that he could get, he'd have to see about getting 25 more. The bet that there is no declaration from this individual supporting the county's allegation that 25 were offered and 25 were refused. Their failure to produce such a declarant seems to me cast doubt on the city's on the county's representation that they in fact made the offer. In addition to the question of alternative housing, although the county posted a two-page list of what was represented to be housing assistance and other types of assistance, as indicated in Monica Tone's declaration and in a number of other declarations, I believe, efforts to contact the phone numbers listed were totally unavailing. That in shelter after shelter, agency after agency listed, the response was nothing available. We have no room, or we can put you on a waiting list. Or in some cases, there was no answer at all. So the impact of to the extent that distributing that list is argued as satisfying the obligation to provide alternative housing, it fails, and I don't think anything came of it. And to this day, we are still getting reports. We tried to put some of them in the updated, our supplemental brief this morning, they're still being notified that there are no spaces. In addition, Your Honor, many of the spaces or rather say agencies and services listed are limited in who they might take. And they're not available to all in the case of families, in the case of sometimes single men, sometimes they're exclusively women, this issue of families. And so the list is not the equivalent of alternative available housing. With regard to the vouchers, again, I met with council on the 19th and spent some time and raised a number of questions that's all listed out in my declaration specifics. We said from the outset that we were not opposed to having people move to these rooms so long as we could get some time to move them in such a manner as they would be not traumatized, that all of their possessions would be safeguarded in some manner, they'd have access to them, and that the rooms would actually be located in such a manner as they wouldn't be unnecessarily moved a tremendous distance from the encampment. In fact, the only information we got, council said they would have someone from the Department of Social Services. That person does not appear on the Zoom call. I asked a number of questions. The best they could do was to tell me that the cities of Greenfield, Salinas, and Marina were locations where in the past they've had the ability to find rooms at motels. No identification of the motels, no answers to questions with regard to how long these vouchers, if they would extend past 5 days, no discussion about transportation. No one was offered transportation, even though we advised that the majority of our members and other campers actually sought the vouchers, made the request to have the vouchers. They were then told, well, you have to fill up this box first, this relatively small storage bin, and then you qualify to get a voucher. Many, as reflected in the declarations, did so, and yet they were not provided with a voucher. The best that was offered was the question, are you interested in getting a voucher? And most answered yes, and that was as far as it went. We, again, if there's no direct evidence by way of declaration or any other credible proof that the offers were made, that the offers made were made and were rejected. That simply is not the case, and I think we've shown, therefore, that there is no actually available appropriate indoor housing or any or alternative shelter being made available to those who would be otherwise displaced. So I think the impact of that is clear. With regard to the second question, the related question of the size of the encampment, and therefore if the unavailability of alternative housing is a link in the chain leading to a state-created danger. We believe that we have satisfied this element and made the necessary showing at this stage, raised serious questions as to whether the state's affirmative acts, or I should say the county's affirmative acts, have in place and will place, they threatened to place and did place as a result of a day and a half's worth of continuing the sweeps, despite knowing that we were going to bring this motion and despite our efforts to agree to delay things so we could work things out, that in fact we have seen the harm. We have seen an increased risk of harm. We have seen, as indicated in the declarations, people who have lost their possessions, including tents, tarps, various means by which they were protected previously from the elements, food in some cases, personal items, clothing, and sleeping bags, and have had, at best, the president of our union, Ms. Tony, was able to set up a warming center under the Pajaro River Bridge, where about 10 people were. I know that your order, Your Honor, indicated people could return. Had been point of fact that was very difficult for many, if not all of those, at least 17 encampments destroyed, and maybe twice the number of persons. It was very difficult because they lost the things they would need to actually construct or reconstruct their campground.
So let me interject there, Mr. Prince, because I think that in the Ninth Circuit, the district district courts that have dealt with state-created danger are pretty much in line. In fact, I think they are in line that it's a relative term, if you will. It's is there some action taken by the government entity that puts the person in a more dangerous, makes them more vulnerable than they were before. And here we have an encampment. We have people living outdoors, some with some forms of shelter, but they're living on the levee or the banks of the river. And if that encampment is cleared, and if there's no shelter housing, they move and they camp elsewhere. Isn't that what happens?
That's what generally happens, and that has happened in the past because these are kind of an annual event, these sweeps, the last one being December 7th, 2020. 80 encampments were essentially bulldozed. But the situation here, Your Honor, is that the loss of they simply can't, if they go elsewhere to camp, they go without a tent in many cases. They go without the tarps. They go without the sheds, structures, and kind of makeshift kind of facilities that they were using to protect themselves. So there, but, the state, are, okay. the government.
But this is not a situation where, I don't think there's any dispute about this. This is not a situation where the government came in at dawn one day and started clearing camps. This is a situation where there was notice provided, and I appreciate some of the individuals indicate that they did not receive notice or didn't see it, but it doesn't seem to be disputed that notice, you know, a week prior and with postings on structures of the need to evict. So isn't that how the government addresses that? I mean, I've seen that in other cases, and that seems to be the steps that were followed here.
Well, as you're aware, Your Honor, we have the courts have found a state-created danger, even where there has been some advance word or some notice. In this case, the notice was woefully insufficient and inadequate, and we made this point at the outset. Our original intent and effort was to simply get some more time. It was an unrealistic amount of time. The 10th notice posted on the 10th. There's an intervening weekend, and then we have just a few days before the encampments would be cleared on the 17th. The notice, I think notice has to be effective. It can't be illusory. It can't be such that it's almost impossible or virtually impossible to comply with. You have people there who have a number of possessions. You've seen some of the photographs. You have structures. You have, in some cases, people have been there for years. And you have a significant percentage of individuals who have disabilities of one kind or another, for whom on its face, 7 days seems like a lot, but it's not. It is not enough. It is insufficient. And we were told this repeatedly by the campers themselves that they couldn't comply. We see this everywhere where, even here, where the counties or cities will defend by saying, well, we gave them time and we gave you the opportunity to move. But if there is no other place to go realistically and such that they could bring the things they need to survive with them, then that notice is ineffectual. It's illusory. And we think that's the case here.
Well, what is enough time? What is enough notice? Because if you're saying... what I thought you just said was that if there's no alternative housing, then the notice is illusory. And I don't think that one follows from the other. But maybe go ahead.
Well, I would say that they are very closely connected, because for the sake of argument, say that there's more than sufficient notice. Okay, well then you have notice. But
okay, let's say 30 days. Let's say that they got 30 days notice.
Okay, well, I would say that with 30 days, the argument becomes a little less compelling, but that's substantially more notice that is provided in these cases, far more than the notice provided here. But let's say that there is adequate notice. There's still a state-created danger if the government entity moves performs an affirmative act which increases the risk of harm that would otherwise not be there if they simply left the campers alone. These campers did have protection from the elements. They did have places to be. They had places for their possessions, in some cases accumulated over a period of years. And so even if there was sufficient notice, in this case, we don't believe there was. We believe that it was woefully inadequate. But even if there was, that is not synonymous with the absence of conditions leading to a state-created danger. What's happened here is the state has said, the county has essentially said, you need to leave here. And combined with the fact that we don't have any place for you to go, we don't have sufficient or certainly not enough or immediately available for all of the people who are threatened with eviction, you just have to go. That is an affirmative act by the government which increases the risk of harm. For example, in Ms. Johnson's, Elise Johnson's declaration, she spells out in detail what will happen, that she won't have any place, she has no transportation. If they store her things, she has no way to retrieve them, whether she needs them on a regular basis or at some point in time. There is no, that her husband works in the fields. She's married to a farm worker. The fields are right adjacent to the encampment. He will not be able to work. That obviously could lead to irreparable harm, loss of income immediately, possibly the loss of the job itself. If he was in Greenfield, 50 miles away, he wouldn't be able to hold that job. And yet this is the kind of affirmative action step that the state, that the county has taken that increases the risk. And again, that's the standard, is the risk of harm increased? And rather than speculate, Your Honor, we can actually see that it had, that the increased risk of harm has manifested itself with those who filed declarations in this case, who actually were deprived of their property. In some cases, because they couldn't fit everything into the storage bins and no storage elsewhere was provided, or even if it was offered or provided, was so far by the time they get to another location, or even if they remain camped somewhere else on the river, they don't have vital possessions anymore because they were told you have to get rid of them or they'll be destroyed.
All right, so Mr. Prince, yeah. let me interject, because you're making an argument, as I understand it, that that eviction, and even if there's notice, right? Even if there's adequate notice, that if the unsheltered person does not, isn't able to act on that, either does not or cannot act pursuant to the notice, so they are evicted. There's some way to collect possessions, but I'll take your argument that it's not sufficient. Okay. That under those situations, that basically whenever there's eviction, there's a state created danger. And obviously, again, the cases, the case law, the directions from the Ninth Circuit don't support that. Because every case indicates, I think this is consistent, that, wherever the narrow holdings are, that a municipality can restrict encampments under certain circumstances. And those are all very fact specific as to when that might be appropriate. So here we have, a great deal of evidence put before the court about the waterway and the floodplain and the federal regulations and the state regulations, and the fact that this is not publicly accessible property. So, we seem to get very quickly to the, is this a situation where the state, where the, we move quickly to the balance of equities. Is this [S2] Right. [S1] A situation where the state or county can and is it is appropriate to not allow encampments on this particular land?
Well, I would agree, Your Honor, that not every eviction is the equivalent, legal equivalent or factual equivalent of a state-created danger. But I think in some cases, the eviction under certain conditions and within a certain context can get us on the road towards a state-created danger, if not create that danger at the outset, immediately. Mm-hmm. For example, we are evicting people in this case. The first thing is we're evicting them with a substantial loss of property. So evictions, as a general rule, in fact, people who are evicted in other contexts, landlord-tenant, or as you say, even in some of the cases, the homeless encampment cases, simply saying you have to go without more, without a showing that eviction has increased the risk of harm by the affirmative act of the eviction. I see the court's point. But on the other hand, if a government entity could insulate itself or immunize itself from state-created danger by simply saying, well, it's just an eviction, we're just removing people because they can't be in this area, well, then you could never raise this 14th Amendment argument. You could never say a danger could be created. I mean, the cases, for example, where an innkeeper, you know, evicts or expels someone from a tavern into a winter storm. Well, in most cases, they certainly have the right to eject someone from an establishment like that. But if they're ejected into conditions that increase the risk of harm, and that's a private actor, but in the case of the government entity, that is a state-created danger. So this isn't merely an eviction, Your Honor. We feel what this is a displacement that is not justified, and it was rushed. It was, and the way it's been conducted, Your Honor, I think speaks to the nature of it being a state-created danger, because it's not an eviction in which people are provided all that they need, or I should say, they've been deprived of what they need after they've been evicted. And I think that gets us on the road to state-created danger, and I think we've already seen it. People now are gathering under a bridge without a shelter. It's just a warming center. It's not even a proper location. It can't be compared to what they had in the encampment. And they're just huddling in a place that has blankets to provide some warmth under a bridge because of the affirmative act of Monterey County. That's a state-created danger. People are more at risk. This is a population, as you know, Your Honor, that is already a marginalized community that has vulnerabilities, particular vulnerabilities for this subset of the population. And now they're more at risk for those already existing vulnerabilities to manifest themselves. And I think the declarations speak to that. So I don't think every eviction is necessarily the equivalent of state-created danger. But I think the circumstances here, the lack of available alternatives, the deprivation, and even, Your Honor, even if things are stored for a period of time, it's still essentially a deprivation. It still makes it extremely difficult, if not impossible, for someone to access, you know, a storage. Is a deprivation if there's no realistic possibility for someone to retrieve those items. And there is none here, Your Honor. They're asking people who may end up across the county, 50 miles away, to come back to where the items are being stored and retrieve that item. Well, that's a state-created danger that we don't want to wait for it to manifest itself and harm to occur. This is about a preliminary injunction. This is about preventing that type of harm. And I think we've made a sufficient showing that those are exactly the kind of heightened risks that the county has now foisted upon those who have been essentially routed out of this camp.
Let me turn to Ms. Panchenko, and then it's your motion, Mr. Prince, so I'll be back.
Your Honor, I'm sorry for the interruption.
That's all right.
I'm being emailed by Ms. Via that Ms. Holmes is in the hearing as an attendee and needs to be promoted. I don't have her as an attendee. So I'm not sure what the problem is this afternoon, but I'm not able to promote someone if they're not showing up as an attendee. So if she's coming in under another name, so that I can promote her, but I don't have any way to promote her into the hearing at this time.
Madam Clerk, if I may, Ms. Holmes is actually in my office, so she, if needed, she can just step into the frame with me here. So please don't worry about that email. Thank you very much for your assistance.
Thank you.
All right. Ms. Pachenko, I think you have the court's issues firmly in mind.
Yes.
Let's start, though, with the vouchers. I mean, what was offered, what not offered? I'm aware of what the county and the water agency, what the defendants put in the declarations in terms of what was, and you've seen the disputed facts around that. So what clarification can you offer?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and I'm happy to answer with respect to all of the points you've made at the beginning of this hearing with respect to the Eighth Amendment and the state-created danger. But I'll start with the motel vouchers. First, I just want to acknowledge that defendants do not concede that we are legally obligated to offer shelter and alternative housing to plaintiffs. But notwithstanding that, plaintiffs' argument that no motel vouchers were offered is completely false and disingenuous. Plaintiff's counsel conceded himself in his own ex parte documents that they were offered to his clients by my colleague, Ms. Donlan. They were again offered on our November 18th meet and confer with all counsel on Thursday. To date, no response or acceptance has been provided to us. As of October 4th, Your Honor, and this is all set forth in the declaration of Lauren Suansupa at docket 4-3, the Department of Social Services actually issued motel vouchers that were provided through CSUMB volunteers in the area, essentially in anticipation of the cleanup efforts. They also provided extensive resources that individuals could be connected to. And as I mentioned in my own declaration with to just touch on shelter availability, I personally called a very close shelter to the river area on Friday and was informed that at least 10 beds were available. And actually, as an aside, they returned my phone calls 6 different times encouraging me to fill out an intake form. So just wanted to touch on that issue.
Let me go back to the vouchers, because I get that at least at a policy level, it sounds like there were vouchers available, but what evidence did the defendants have, if any, as to vouchers actually being offered to the folks at the encampment?
Well, this was set forth, as I mentioned, in the declaration of Lauren Suansupa, who is a Department of Social Services employee. I have had conversations in preparation for this briefing with other staff who have represented that they were offered. And then I personally offered, along with Ms. Holmes during our meet and confer, to Mr. Prince and his clients these vouchers, and they have not been accepted to date.
Now, before all this dispute around whether or not vouchers were offered, I had some concerns, and again, I'm working my way through the impact of if we have a camp of 200 people. And there's an offer of 25 vouchers for 5 days. You know, that's not perhaps very impactful. And again, I appreciate the defendant's position of there's no obligation to provide it, and I'm not assuming that there is. But again, I just want to be sure I understand around the vouchers. What information did the defendants have in terms of availability of vouchers, availability for more vouchers? How does this work, and how does it work in this case?
Well, again, as explained in the Department of Social Services declaration,
I read the declaration. That's why I'm asking the question.
Of course, yes, Your Honor. There is a motel voucher program that the county runs. through the Department of Social Services. It's available to anyone experiencing homelessness. These vouchers were issued, you know, for this purpose, but they are ordinarily also issued as part of other requests that are made in the county. I also want to touch on the number of people. We discussed this with plaintiff's counsel. The numbers, you know, the number of 200 is not the number that has been reported to us. We have had reports of far less individuals in this area. And the part of the river at issue here, Your Honor, is a 1 mile stretch. But ultimately, this is a very long river. There is a Santa Cruz County side to it as well. So I just wanted to make a note of that and bring that to your attention.
But can you tell me what your numbers are? I mean, what is, from the municipality's point of view, how many people are in this encampment?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I have heard reports of 25. I've also heard reports of 40-some different encampment areas. So somewhere between those numbers are the reports that I have heard.
Okay.
And if I may, Your Honor, make a couple of more points. I think plaintiff's counsel would like this court to believe that this case here is analogous to federal encampment actions such as the City of Santa Cruz, City of Novato, and City of Sausalito, which all involve municipal parks. But here, the facts just couldn't be further from the instant case. The individuals occupying the Pajaro River area are unlawfully trespassing into a restricted and dangerous levee area owned and controlled by the Water Resources Agency under strict regulation by other agencies such as the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which originally built this area in the 1940s. This area has never been open for public access, much less camping, and as we've noted in all of our papers, it is a very dangerous area for plaintiffs and other individuals to be staying in as a result of, because of flood control purposes. I also want to note that the regulations governing WARA's authority in the area make the area completely incompatible with human habitation. The levees support flood control, and they're there to prevent catastrophic flood events to the neighboring Pajaro community and the neighboring agricultural fields. As I've noted in the papers, there were several catastrophic flooding events, and those levees are there for that purpose. So the closure of the area from the public is not only lawful, it is federally mandated. So I really want to make sure to frame this all in the context that these individuals are unlawfully trespassing into an area that is very dangerous, not only to them, but as a result of their conduct, is very dangerous to all of the surrounding communities. As noted in other declarations, there have been tunnels dug into the riverbank, which run the risk of slope collapse and injury or death to the individuals staying there. And there's a lot of debris and garbage and waste directly in the waterway, which can cause a really big risk to flooding and water diversion. And this was all, of course, included in our materials. So I just wanted to make those points because I think they're critical here for the court's consideration.
And let me interject there, Ms. Pinchenko, because yes, the defendants put in a lot of evidence around the health and safety issues associated with this specific property. But that also raises the question of these encampments have been there a long time. And it may be that they're cleared out from time to time, but in point of fact, people have been camping here. And doesn't that undermine the, this is so dangerous and this can't go on and this is, you know, in violation of federal regulations, et cetera, when in fact the encampment, this land has been used as encampments for a very long time?
Well, there have been repeated cleanup efforts, and in the declaration of Russ Yoshimaru, he noted that people were always cooperative in leaving because one of the responsibilities of the WRA is to ensure there are no trespassers. It's required of the federal agencies that regulate the area that the area be kept completely clear of encroachments. And I want to touch on plaintiff's argument about irreparable harm here, because I think it's important. I think that plaintiffs are at far greater danger staying in the levee area than relocating. As I mentioned, one of the risks is these tunnels that are being dug into the riverbank has, you know, created a really substantial danger to their health and safety. There's a critical risk of flooding. We are already in the rainy season and anticipating storms. And the conditions of the levee are unsafe. In addition to the fact that there's really dire public health and safety issues that we detailed in the declaration of Chief Thornburg with the Sheriff's Department and Brent Buki, who is with the WRA. So it is far more dangerous for plaintiffs to continue staying in the area. And the county is not prohibiting them from going elsewhere in the county. This is not a case that is an issue of criminalizing homelessness, as plaintiff's counsel would like it to be. There is no ordinance here that is criminalizing homelessness. And if I may, I'd like to touch on that, because I think that touches on the Eighth Amendment argument and the Boise decision. So first, I want to just make the point that Martin versus Boise is entirely inapplicable to the facts of our case here. First, that decision held that it is unlawful for a municipal entity to criminalize homelessness where there is no available shelter. As I mentioned, there's no ordinance here doing that. But here, also, plaintiffs are not occupying public property such as a park or a public sidewalk. They are occupying a restricted and dangerous levee area that is being damaged by the encroachments, with vehicles being driven over the levee, and actually may be further compromised with the impending winter storms. But even if the Boise decision applied, Your Honor, the court, the Ninth Circuit held that the holding was a narrow one, and it actually opined that public entities are not limited by their ability to restrict homeless individuals from certain places. There's an entire series of recent federal decisions that support this that are in our papers. And the Boise decision itself actually stated that the holding does not apply to individuals who do have access to temporary shelter but choose not to use it, which is the case here. And it even went so far as to say that a public entity could theoretically pass lawfully an ordinance barring sitting, lying, or sleeping, and it would be permissible in instances such as a public right-of-way or a location where a building is going to be erected. The levee area here, I think, is an even more compelling example because it presents known, not speculative, because we have historical evidence of floods here, known flood dangers, and these dangers are being exacerbated by plaintiffs and other individuals' conduct with all of the waste and all of the objects that are being put directly into the levee and the levee being damaged. So the levee has to remain restricted in order for the WRA to comply with federal requirements, and for the levees to fulfill their function and maintain their integrity.
So, Ms. Pachinko, you raised the debris and the conditions in and around the levee, and there was an issue raised in the papers, the late papers that were filed, challenging some of the photographs as being not from the relevant area and not current. Does the county have a response to that?
I do not, Your Honor, have a response to that necessarily. I certainly am glad to inquire since the court is asking about those photographs. But as I understand it, those were current conditions. And as the declaration set out, all current conditions were described in all of the declarations that were submitted.
All right. Tell me, Ms. Pachinko, before I circle back to Mr. Prince, it sounded like the parties did have a meeting last week. And I thought there was a reference to a meeting on the 19th, on Friday the 19th, a meet and confer. But maybe that was the 18th. What was the outcome of that meeting? were next steps or a path forward discussed?
We discussed, and my apologies, I believe it was Thursday the 18th, and the deadline for plaintiffs to file something was the following day, if my memory serves me right. We had discussed, you know, a possible stipulation, but, you know, defendants have, you know, filed their position here, and so we are respectfully asking this court to deny plaintiffs' request for a preliminary injunction. We discussed the motel vouchers. There was some additional information that plaintiffs' counsel had questions about that we're happy to follow up with our departments on. But I specifically recall talking about motel vouchers and offering transportation vouchers and also storage of personal belongings that is local and available to plaintiffs or anyone else in the river area. So that was the extent of our conversation, and plaintiff's counsel acknowledged the filing deadline. So we were very surprised by this morning's briefing.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Pacheco. All right. Mr. Prince, you know, we still have the issue of this heavily regulated land, not accessible to the public. Persons experiencing homelessness, camping there. I think that there is credible evidence, certainly, of the of public health and safety issues arising out of that presence on the levees. And that would, I mean, it, you know, it's like, you know, isn't this like being camping on a runway? You know, something where it's dangerous. It's dangerous to the individuals. It's danger to the public. Can have other ramifications. That there's some land that is just not appropriate. Even if there aren't enough beds, and that's a very difficult situation. It's a much bigger problem than the issue before this court today. So in those circumstances and in the circumstances that have been developed by the defendants, isn't restriction on camping appropriate and go from there?
Well, I'll answer that question, Your Honor. Then if I could, I wanted to circle back to address some of the issues that counsel raised. It's obvious that we're not, certainly not happy with having people camping in any kind of dangerous circumstance, and we would be willing, and we offered from the giddy up and continue to offer to work collaboratively with the county to addressing hazards and possibly relocating campers to an area where these risks would not present themselves. I'll point out that Monica Tony, who was the first person, one of the first to be noticed, and her name appeared on the notice to vacate. Her campsite isn't even in the on the riverbank. It's maybe 25, 30 feet away from the riverbank, and yet she was posted. She's arguably not in the direct path or contributing in any way to any obstruction in the path of the river, on the riverbank or in the river bottom. And that's true for a number of the encampments that have been bulldozed on the 17th and the 18th, that they're not, they do not fit the description, do not constitute standing alone structural impediments or potential impediments to the flow of the river. Also, Your Honor, there is no evidence whatsoever that to any tunnels have been, I'm answering your question, are there places that are inappropriate? Of course, but I think in this case that the defendants are exaggerating or perhaps offering out, making out a whole cloth in conditions that simply do not exist. There are no tunnels. Initially, counsel indicated that our plaintiffs had tunneled into the levee. She had to backtrack and say she was mistaken. She meant to say that the plaintiffs have tunneled into the riverbank. Then she had to backtrack off that and say, well, there are incursions into the riverbank. But the fact of the matter is that there are no tunnels, and there's no evidence of a tunnel, as
I don't think tunnels is a key point.
All right, I'll get off of that.
I mean, Ms. Tone herself indicated, showed the steps going down to the river. So, right. I mean, there's clearly living activity in and around.
Yes, that's right. That's beyond dispute. The issue here is that we don't have an objection to remedying or even relocating people to a safer location. What we're saying is that what the county has done here by just simply, you're out of here. You got to be out of here. It doesn't matter where you go. You just got to be out of here. On the basis of a perceived imminent threat of a disaster occurring, is not supported by the evidence. First of all, as you pointed out, Your Honor, if this threat was as imminent as defendants describe in their papers, why has that encampment? Those encampments been allowed to be there, not just over the years, but even in the last weeks and months. We were told during the meet and confer and in other conversations that one of the reasons that they needed to move quickly, that they had to post on the 10th and have people out of there by the 17th, was that the water district and the other related agencies had been working for weeks and months on addressing the issues in the river bottom. Well, if that's true, if they were aware of these issues, why weren't steps taken earlier? Also, Your Honor, there's no evidence that any federal oversight agency or any of the other agencies that counsel perhaps accurately describe as having some authority over the river and the river banks and the river bottom and the levees, that they've come out and issued any kind of order. There's no evidence in the record that these authoritative federal agencies have come up and said, you need to get these people out of here. But there is evidence, and I think it's in some of the county's own moving papers and declarations of the water district people, that there have been these officials have come out to that site. And obviously, but no action was taken as a result of those visits. I think that to the extent that there is any kind of threat, I think that it's exaggerated. I think that it can be remedied with a less intrusive approach, that it need not be addressed or resolved in a mass expulsion, a destruction of property, no attention paid to where the persons removed may go. And also, Your Honor, this matter, and again, the counsel just indicated that she doesn't have any information or response to the declaration filed by Ms. Tone to the effect that the photographs, which supposedly show a car and they show, some of these other things, are actually in the area that was targeted November 17th and 18th and beyond. And while it's true that there's been some minor modifications or minor, kind of people putting little steps just kind of leveled out from this, so that people can get down to the flat part, which has been flat for eons, as for the normal erosion of flat surface where some of these shelters are, tents are, that has not arisen to the level of a serious threat, substantial structural threat to either the riverbank or the levee. So we question the justification that the county's providing here. We question their failure to find or even discuss prior to taking this action a less intrusive means of getting people out of what they say is harm's way. Also, if I could, Your Honor, the suggestion that we rejected and that I personally rejected the offer of shelter is simply not true. If you look at footnote one on page four of our supplemental brief, what happened was that the city almost soon after we initiated the litigation said, well, we'll provide a voucher to Monica Tone. We'll get her a room tonight, but we made it clear to them, and it says right here that Ms. Tone will not accept any offer that is not also made to those in her encampment. I mean, what they want to do is say, well, you can have a room, but there was no immediate actual commitment or distribution of vouchers or other housing to anybody else. And so there's no way that we were going to agree one person, the lead defendant, the president of the union, could be taken care of and nobody else. And also, Your Honor, it may very well be that the various agencies provided CSUMB personnel, or the one person we know of, Mr. Valcure, who came down with five vouchers, he may have been provided those, but that's not the equivalent of him actually presenting them, producing them, and offering them to people down in the encampments. Council is calling to question signed sworn declarations from people who requested, were not provided with those vouchers, and otherwise would have accepted them. We actually instructed and urged all of our members to request, not just if they're offered, but to actively seek out those vouchers, and they were not provided. So, you know, the notion that we have consistently failed to approve of or cooperate with, see, just the opposite. We encouraged the vouchers. The whole point of the meet and confer on the 18th or 19th, whatever it was to discuss specifically, you know, that relocation to motels. I asked at least 8 or 9 questions about the name. It's all spelled out in detail in my declaration. None of those questions were answered, and no one was provided at that meet and confer who would have. No one from social services. And even now today, as we sit here, I still haven't been provided, as counsel's indicated, still haven't been provided that information. We're not opposed to that. What we need is the information so that we can assess and ascertain for ourselves that whatever is going to be provided is going to be durable, won't be just an in and out. As you know, Judge, in the Santa Cruz case, you made the point that a voucher that's only good for 2 or 3 days is needs to be looked at carefully, because that's not very long duration. And finally, Your Honor, the question of the location of the a campment that's in or close by banks of a river or a levee is not necessarily per se unsafe. I think we achieved a very acceptable and so far so good resolution in the Santa Cruz case. And that involved a stipulated preliminary injunction. There was a little back and forth, and the court became involved actively in this process. That the Benchlands encampment could be argued to be somewhat, not exactly identical, but somewhat shares some of the similar characteristics. And that encampment now has close to 300 people. It's so far, things seem to be working well. There's always problems. And that was the relocation of encampment from higher ground, a section of San Lorenzo Park that was higher, at a higher elevation, down to a lower elevation. And the city of Santa Cruz itself is moving in a cooperative direction should any kind of indication of flooding or any kind of problem present itself. These things can be worked out. You know, the approach of the county is just to herd people out, take their possessions, is not the way to go forward with this situation.
Final comments, Mr. Prince.
I'm sorry?
I said final comments? Wrap it up?
Yeah. I would just say, Your Honor, that we are at the stage in the litigation of freezing everything in place, of preserving the status quo, so that a full and complete evidentiary record, amongst other things, but primarily that, can be created. There are a lot of unanswered questions here. There's a lot of evidence and facts that are in dispute. There are people we need to hear from. There are, witnesses that perhaps a full evidentiary hearing is called for. And we would favor that. And we suggest that. And in the interim, that the temporary restraint, if the preliminary injunction does not, the court sees fit not to issue the preliminary injunction today, at least extend the temporary restraining order, so that we may have a full evidentiary hearing and or perhaps involve one of the magistrates, well, you're a magistrate judge, but perhaps another one to help us settle. As you know, we've had some real success in the Novato case, which was essentially settled with the active help of another magistrate judge. We're moving, we would like to see a resolution of this, but we can't have our people placed in harm's way by these affirmative acts. And we would urge the court, we believe that we've satisfied the elements at this stage of the litigation, and that there is no harm to the city, the county, by preserving the status quo and moving towards the next steps in the litigation, and possibly towards, we hope, an informal resolution of the case, perhaps with the assistance of the court or someone appointed by the court.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Prince. Ms. Panchenko, that was, there was some additional argument. I'll give you just a moment if you'd like to respond.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of points. It is the defendant's position that we have no obligation here to provide shelter for reasons I have already explained. However, our Department of Social Services is very committed to helping all homeless individuals in the county, and there are a list of resources available, and I just wanted to mention that. I also want to just say that the property at issue here, which, as I mentioned, belongs to the Water Resources Agency and is under their control, is levee to levee. There is virtually nowhere else to move these individuals on the river. I also can confirm that the pictures that were included and as part of the declaration of Brent Buki are current, as well as the pictures that were included as part of the declaration of Chief Thornburg. Those are all current photographs taken, and of course their declarations talk about all recent events. I just wanted to again touch base on motel vouchers. We have offered, as I've mentioned, 25 vouchers, and the response was we will not pick and choose who gets to go. However, there's been no request for a different number. There's also a dispute as to how many people we're talking about. So perhaps that is a further discussion that can be had. Finally, I just want to make a couple of concluding remarks. I just want to say that given the substantial historical and known present dangers of flood risk to the area and damage to the levees by the individuals that are trespassing into the area, compounded by the risk of flood and trash and debris obstructing the waterway during already we are in the rainy season, we respectfully ask this court to deny plaintiff's preliminary injunction, because doing so really is in the public interest of local communities. If this injunction stands, or if there's further delay, the WRA will be in violation of federal regulatory requirements. Plaintiff's counsel said that there's no authority mentioned. I just want to direct the court's attention to the declaration of Brent Buki, docket 12-1, paragraph 8, that spells out its public law 84-99 that sets out these requirements. So going to the public interest here, I just want to mention that the nearby agricultural, residential, and business properties in the town of Pajaro may be put at really significant danger during the winter storms if the injunction stands. And I also just want to add that in the event of a flood and we do not remove the encroachments, our federal funding for aid would be jeopardized. This case here, this preliminary injunction, that's at issue here today, Your Honor. The complaint still stands, and we will deal with that at a later stage. But this case here, at this stage, does not hinge on disputed facts, but rather the law here. Plaintiffs are indisputably trespassing into a dangerous and restricted area, and the threat of irreparable harm is really great to them of staying there. So time is of the essence here, and it is our position that plaintiffs are not likely to succeed on the merits. And that's all, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pachenko. Mr. Prince, it is your motion, and I did have you wrap up a moment ago. If you'd like one more minute, you may respond.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, I would say that the issue before the court is the irreparable harm, the imminent harm that has already afflicted those who have been impacted by the removal on 17th and 18th, and that I don't think the evidence shows, we're not convinced by the evidence that the exigent character of the situation where these campers have been located and now are threatened with removal is of the nature that defendants describe. I think the history of the area proves that, and that the imminent, what this court has looked at it and correctly, is what is the harm, the imminent, immediate harm that confronts plaintiffs by the states, or rather the counties, affirmative acts of breaking up the encampment in the way that it has, and the loss of property. Council just said that there's no other place to go. That's a good point. They can't simply go anywhere and camp. They certainly can't be in that area. And camping within the city is problematic for a host of reasons. That's why they're up there on the river and have been for years. So with that, we again urge the board to either grant the motion for preliminary injunction, have an evidentiary hearing, and at least extend the TRO until such time as we can have some substantive settlement discussions or a full evidentiary hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Prince. Matter submitted.
Submitted, Your Honor.
Ms. Pachinko, yes, submitted.
Submitted. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. As I indicated in my order granting the temporary restraining order, the TRO will remain in place until I issue my order on the preliminary injunction, which I will endeavor to do soon, but I'm going to give careful consideration to all the evidence before the court. I will continue to give careful consideration to all the evidence before the court, as well as the arguments here today. If I decide that I need to hear further from the defendants in response to this morning's filings, I will direct that. If I decide that an evidentiary hearing could lend additional insight into the issues, I will order that, but I may also be able to rule on this given the full briefing and argument that we've had here today. All right, so I will move as I can. The TRO stays in effect until that order issues. All right.
Thank you, Judge.
That concludes this matter. So thank you very much, and we are adjourned. Thank you.